Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are spending the hour discussing the environmental effects of the transatlantic slave trade. This issue doesn't get that much attention, but Black archaeologists are trying to change that. They are also telling the full experience of Black history beyond the maps and statistics. Today's guest, Dr. Justin Dunavant, investigates the relationship between ecology and enslavement in the former Danish West Indies, which is now the U.S. Virgin Islands. Dr. Dunavant has searched for and excavated the underwater wrecks of slave ships and has done archaeological work in Ethiopia, Jamaica, Tanzania, Mozambique, and the Gambia. Dr. Justin Dunavant is assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at UCLA, co-founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists, and an instructor with Diving with a Purpose. That's an organization that specializes in the documentation, protection, and interpretation of African slave trade shipwrecks. Dr. Dunavant is also a National Geographic explorer, and he's featured in this month's cover story called Into the Depths, Searching for Shipwrecks from Slavery's Hidden Past to Help Heal the Present. Hi, Dr. Dunavant. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Rose, it's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's an honor to have you on the show. And I've just learned so much doing the research about the work you do with Diving for a Purpose, the Society of Black Archaeologists. And I understand that you didn't get interested in archaeology until you were an undergrad at Howard. You actually started as an international business major, which is the complete opposite of archaeology. So tell us how this all began.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I didn't know what an archaeologist was when I was growing up. I haven't seen Indiana Jones movies. I've seen snippets, but I haven't sat through an entire movie yet. So my idea of an archaeologist was really shaped by my experience in undergrad. I wanted to study abroad, and I wanted to eventually live abroad. And so I assumed business and international were the two words you put together to make a major to do that. but thankfully, my freshman year, I had the opportunity to go on an archaeology dig in Belize, in the rainforest. And after sleeping in a tent for 6 weeks, a lot of people got annoyed and were ready to go home. But I decided to dive headfirst into it and see what the potential could look like to be an emerging archaeologist after the experience.
What was that experience like in Belize?
Man, it was transformative. I think for me, I was always interested in history. But I had never associated this concept with the fact that a lot of historians are writing about work that has been discovered by archaeologists. And so when I realized archaeology was a discipline that I could get into, I said, I literally have the ability to shape what types of histories and stories are told and how those histories and stories are told. So that really kind of sinked me in.
I read in FredMag.com that you had a really amazing experience working on a Buffalo Soldier archaeology project in Texas, because you were working with kids from a local reservation, and also you were working with Black kids. So can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, I was an undergrad then as well. Dr. Eleanor King, who's still a professor at Howard University, was running this Buffalo Soldier archaeology project. And I didn't realize how sort of transformative it was at the time as a student. But, you know, growing up and getting deeper into the field, I started to realize how significant it was that we were excavating a Buffalo Soldier campsite with students from historically Black college, in this case, Howard University, and with students from the local reservation. And that was the first time I had understood of a project where we have all of the different groups whose ancestors are involved in this one place, working together to uncover this history, and then moving forward to see what interpretation could look like. You know, the story of Buffalo Soldiers is very complex and complicated. And for us, it was transformative to learn sort of how the relationships between Black and Indigenous people in this country occurred and developed, and the critical questions we have to ask and reflections we have to have.
And this is why, as you say, representation in archaeology is so important, because the communities deserve to have control over the questions they want to explore, which ones they don't, what stories they want to tell. This is so important. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, at the end of the day, this comes down to empowerment. We realize, just like, you know, me growing up, a lot of people don't know that archaeology is a thing that exists. And oftentimes there's archaeological work being done in nearby neighborhoods that people live in their backyards, sometimes literally, and then around the country. And they have connections to some of these places and don't even know it, whether it's literal ancestral blood connections or if it's, you know, relatives or people coming from a certain state or a certain region. And these narratives help to tell the collective story of individuals, of communities, and of the nation as whole. So we're actively trying to reshape what it is that we describe as the archaeology, not just in the U.S., but around the world, and our history and understanding as human beings.
Right. What is it like for students these days to get into archaeology?
Yeah,
how,
you know,
how difficult is it?
Yeah, it's physically taxing. I will say that we definitely, you know, do get shovels. We're digging holes. It's usually in the hot sun in the places that I work at. Some other places it's the freezing cold. And we often go to places that sometimes people don't necessarily travel to. So we can be in some very remote locations. Archaeology is going through an interesting phase right now in terms of training and education. You know, we have graduate students now, PhD students that are finding opportunities to get more funding, to ask more critical questions, to go to places that we didn't necessarily have access to before, just because of the sheer cost alone. And also technologies are emerging now where we can begin to rethink not only how we excavate, but what we excavate and how we decide to interpret or present the research that we're doing. So it's really a unique transformative moment happening right now.
How did you come to co-found the Society of Black Archaeologists?
Wow, that goes back to my first year of graduate school back in 2010. I had met up with Ayanna Fluellen, who is now Dr. Ayanna Fluellen. At the time, they were an undergraduate student at the University of Florida when I had just started as a graduate student. And we went to a Black psychology conference my first year there, just to see sort of what was happening at Florida A&M University. And in having that experience, we realized we needed a similar organization for Black anthropologists, particularly because we saw an uptick in the amount of archaeological work being done on and about Black sites. But we didn't necessarily see that reflected in the people who were being trained up in the field of archaeology. So after attending that conference, we were on the drive home. We decided we were going to outline what the organization would look like. And then we sent out an email to all of the Black archaeologists we knew and said, if you don't want to be a part of this organization, send us an email. And nobody responded. So we immediately had an organization with members. and then from there, we decided to have an impromptu meeting at one of our professional conferences for archaeology. And it's snowballed into so much more since then.
And so how have things changed since then?
Oh, wow. They've changed significantly. I think on the one hand, you know, we are now professors in universities. So, you know, being a professor versus a grad student offers unique and new opportunities. We now have students that are coming to us and asking us for guidance or to work with us in different areas. There's a lot of things that have happened. We've expanded internationally much wider now. So we have collaborations with Negra Arqueo, which is a group of Black archaeologists in Brazil, with the European Society of Black and Allied Archaeologists, which is a group out of Europe. Mm-hmm. And then we have colleagues all over the Francophone, Lusophone world as well. So it's grown to unique sizes. And then we've gotten trained in underwater archaeology and built collaborations around that too.
You know, it's so interesting doing the show and then learning more about the organization. I was thinking about covering Standing Rock. I remember meeting people who said, we are so tired of white archaeologists telling our story. And now it's time for us to tell our own story.
100%. And, you know, I think that that's, to me, that's the most important aspect of this. And the reason why we started Society of Black Archaeologists was to show different groups and multiple people that we have various narratives to tell. Mm-hmm. And we all need to be at the table when it comes to excavating what history and heritage we think is important and the ways in which we think it needs to be interpreted and passed down. And it might look one way for us as Black archaeologists. It might look a different way for Indigenous archaeologists. And, you know, thankfully, we have colleagues as well who've organized themselves in the Indigenous Archaeology Collective that are doing similar work.
And also just the meaning behind, oh gosh, something like studying a slave ship or finding a slave ship. I mean, I was just watching videos and the process can be just so emotional, especially if you're on one of the first teams that finds one of these ships. Mm-hmm. And just given how personal it is, that's right. A very different experience from, you know, someone else finding the ship. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, from the very beginning, oftentimes when I do my work, it comes from a personal experience and a personal reason. The research is usually a component of us trying to answer this question that affects our community. And so this whole idea of looking for slave ships, I mean, individuals have been doing it before, and we're thankful for the Smithsonian and Slave Wrecks Project and George Washington University and others in the Park Service and beyond for helping to train us how to actually document these wrecks and become certified scuba divers, because it allows us to ask new questions now. So now we have more individuals who can go out and actually begin to look for these wrecks, whereas we only would have had a handful of individuals. We can slowly build out this capacity. And then we can say, now that we know that there are shipwrecks underwater, what other wrecks could be underwater? Or what other aspects or elements of our history are underwater that we don't necessarily read in the history book or don't think to think about? And I have to, again, thank Diving with a Purpose and individuals up with the state archaeologist up in Michigan for locating a Tuskegee Airmen plane wreck that's actually in the Great Lakes up there. And the idea that we have African-American history, again, that's underwater, that doesn't necessarily relate to slavery, again, opens up our mind to a whole other concept of what research we're doing and what we can potentially do.
I mean, it really is fascinating. One of the questions that you have asked in your talks is, what does it mean to chart Black history underwater? You say that so much of our history is underwater, Black history is underwater and associated with water.
Mm-hmm. Yes, 100%. I mean, the beautiful thing about all of this is that I don't even know the questions that need to be asked in the next 5 years.
Wow.
And that's the powerful moment, is that we can begin to train students to have the expertise and the skills ready to take them to the next level so they can ask questions that I'm not even thinking of. And that's exciting to me because, like I said, we don't know what aspects of our history are under there. And we don't know how far it goes back either. I mean, we've got thousands of years of history in this place, over 200,000 years on this planet. And it's wild to think that there's so much out there that could exist underwater when entire land masses are now currently underwater that we haven't even begun to explore.
Wow. I mean, it's such a wild time to be alive for so many reasons. Just exploring all of this, there's so much new information coming out on a regular basis. And can you just talk for a little bit about how, you know, first off, how you got certified? I understand that you really were not a swimmer before all of this. And on some dives, you actually spend about an hour underwater at a time. Is that right?
Yeah, that's all correct. You know, I grew up, I was born with asthma and grew up, you know, in and out of the hospital each year. So the idea of swimming actually was something that I had to learn very early. It's been said that swimming is good for asthma. And so my mother had me enrolled in swimming classes from a very young age. But it was something that I never kept up with. And as soon as I was old enough to leave it, I didn't go back in the swimming pool. I could get from one side of the pool to the other, but by no means was I considered a swimmer. It was members from an organization called Diving with a Purpose. Jay Hagler specifically reached out to us at the Society of Black Archaeologists and said, "Hey, I've been working with the Smithsonian and Slave Wrecks Project mapping shipwrecks. We have a lot of Black scuba divers. We haven't seen any Black American archaeologists. Do you think there's any way we could come together and talk about this?" So we ended up meeting in Washington, D.C., actually. And in D.C., well, we had a conversation and decided it was necessary for us to start a system, a pipeline, and a program to begin to get more Black archaeologists trained as scuba divers so that we could do underwater archaeology. And that's when I called up Dr. Flewellen and I said, "Ayana, are you ready? We're about to start scuba diving." Ayana thought I was a little crazy, but we decided it was necessary to show that there was proof in this concept, and then from there, see what we could do in underwater archaeology.
Being underwater is such an amazing experience. What were your first few dives like?
Oh, it was literally like going into another world. I never really even considered, you know, going to the beach and swimming in the ocean. You just look out and you see a beautiful sort of horizon in the sky, but you don't begin to think about the complexity of what exists down there. And going on my first dive, I'll never forget. I got trained in the quarry in Virginia, so I got my tough training in. And then my first open water dive was in St. Croix in the Virgin Islands. And it was there that I clear visibility, warm water. I got to see sea turtles, sharks. Sharks are not as dangerous as people think. and just a whole new world that opened up to me. And they looked at me like I was just another organism living underwater with them. So it was sort of ironic to be in a situation where you're a stranger, but you feel like you're a part of the environment.
Mm. And then when it comes to tracking the data, when you're exploring a shipwreck, for example. Can you just talk about what is involved in that, digitizing this? Well, so basically you're underwater and you're able to write on underwater paper, and then you can digitize the sketches, make composite maps. So can you just tell us about the process involved?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, many people have gotten certification as recreational scuba divers. And usually in those cases, you're swimming around the ocean, you're observing the natural environment. In some cases, you're actually going to historical sites underwater, like shipwrecks, and swimming through them or swimming around them. For us as underwater archaeologists now, we're actually doing scientific work underwater. So we're going down underwater with our tablets. We have our slates and our pencils where we're taking notes and mapping. We've got our measuring tapes. We've got our compasses. And we are literally mapping shipwrecks underwater, sketching different components of the wreck, and doing all of these surface maps. Part of it, I tell people, is because we do underwater archaeology very differently from the way we do archaeology on land. On land, we tend to excavate in layers from top to bottom, whereas underwater, we have to treat them more like plane crashes. And so we have to excavate and sort of map across distance. And from those things that we're able to map, we're able to get a better understanding of what type of vessel is underwater, perhaps the make, manufacture, rough time frame in which the boat existed. Sometimes the artifacts can tell us what goods it was transporting and give us more clues into where it came from. And then we're able to offer assessments in how to actually preserve a site if it involves covering it up or maybe excavating further to get more information, or perhaps opening it up to tourism in a way that's not intrusive.
And you don't take things out of the water, right?
Yes, we don't take things out of the water at the moment. There are certain projects that necessitate certain objects to be taken out of the water. To conserve things once they're taken out of the water, it's a very costly process and time consuming. So we're usually very selective in terms of what it is that we do take out of the water. A lot of times the particularly the metallic objects we encounter are heavily encrusted in rust. So there's multi-year processes that we have to go through to actually use the chemistry involved to get rid of that rust and to restore these objects. But generally speaking, we try not to take things out of the water, and we encourage others not to as well.
And currently there are fewer than 20 Black archaeologists doing maritime archaeology work related to slavery in the African diaspora. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, I believe those numbers still hold. Yeah. Wow. It's pretty small out there. Yep.
Gosh. And so What an amazing role you're playing, because you're also training the next generation of students to get involved in this work.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I tell people is our goal. I say my vision and my goal is to become irrelevant. So I'm constantly trying to train my replacement and to train others to expand and do this work. We've got a lot of history to catch up with, and it's going to take a lot of people all over the world to get this thing done. So every project that we do, me and my colleague, Dr. Ayanna Flewellen, have said it needs to have a media component and a training component. So it doesn't matter if we're looking at an artifact under a microscope or if we're planning out, you know, a $1 million project, there's going to be a component that brings in students, and there's going to be a way for us to record the process. And it's already starting to pay benefits. I have 3 PhD students here at UCLA at the moment. We just came back from a trip in Alabama, where we're setting up a potential project for one of those students. And already we've got one who's just got certified as a scientific scuba diver. One of my PhD students, Jewel Humphrey, was an undergraduate student at Howard University when we first met her, didn't know how to swim, came with us on an archaeology dig, fell in love with it, taught herself how to swim, got certified as a scuba diver, and just passed her scientific scuba diving certification last week. So it's wild.
Oh, that's great. And what is the project in Alabama?
Yeah, so there's going to be some more future work around excavating Africatown as a community. Mm. The details are still forthcoming, but many people know about the slave ship, the Clotilda, that was recently located in Mobile, Alabama. And Africatown is the community that was developed from those people who made it off that ship. So there's going to be some more archaeological work that's done there. Some people have done archaeology in the past. And potentially seeing how that narrative fits into a wider narrative in Alabama about Black independence and freedom post-emancipation.
Today, we are spending the hour with Dr. Justin Donovan, assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at UCLA, co-founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists, and an instructor with Diving for a Purpose, an organization that specializes in the protection and interpretation of African slave trade shipwrecks. Dr. Donovan is also a National Geographic explorer, and he's featured in this month's cover story called Into the Depths, Searching for Shipwrecks from Slavery's Hidden Past to Help Heal the Present. If you have any questions for Dr. Donovan about his work, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you are familiar with this incredible group, Diving With a Purpose, and you've maybe read or seen the cover of National Geographic, and you have any comments about this work, we'd love to hear from you. You can email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Justin, you recently gave a talk at Occidental College, and you showed an interactive visual of the transatlantic slave trade. And I have to say, I think I've seen things before like this, but it just really stopped me in my tracks. I had to pause it and then go back 20 seconds and just really watch it. It shows dots representing different voyages on slave ships traveling from West Africa from 1658. And they all have, there's so much information about all of those dots, and you can find that at the Slave Voyages database. Can you just talk about the power of showing this visual?
Definitely, yes. You can access that visualization from slavevoyages.org, and it's got an entire database of all of the documented slave ships that were coming from West Africa to the Americas, and they've more recently added documentation of slave ships going throughout the Americas, even after the transatlantic slave trade is abolished. So the amount of information in that is massive. I show that visualization to my students and to others just to reaffirm how significant and how global the transatlantic slave trade was. But oftentimes when we do this research, there's so much that we have to sort of piece together that it often becomes overwhelming. And as a result of that, we just sort of walk away understanding or remembering one component of this. But in showing that visualization, I show them when the transatlantic slave trade stopped, it was at its height, according to these visualizations. And many more countries continued the transatlantic slave trade. So when we say, 1807, the transatlantic slave trade stopped, what we're really saying is that there was a continuation. It was merely one country that said that they were no longer going to do it. The snowball effect of that has ramifications that extend into all other arenas. And that's when I go into this discussion of the environmental impacts of the transatlantic slave trade and why we need to look at the full ramifications on this earth when we talk about slavery.
And we'll talk about the environmental impacts after a break, but just to give out one more fact and another visual, really, between 1500 and 1875, 4.8 million enslaved Africans were brought to the Caribbean, 389,000 were brought to the United States, and 1 million died on the way to those destinations.
Mm-hmm. And that's just what's been documented, because we know there were illicit trades happening throughout multiple centuries. As a result of that, those numbers could be even more highly inflated.
Mm-hmm. You also describe, and I thought this was so fascinating and makes so much sense, but this is where the environment is also so important to think about, just in terms of how once a ship left West Africa, why it hit the Caribbean first.
Right. Yeah.
That's a lot of that has fascinating.
The natural world is a fascinating thing, and it has really dictated a lot of what we consider as world history. The ocean currents, the environmental patterns, they naturally will bring ships from that point in Western Africa over to the Americas. The reason why they hit the Caribbean first is because that's the way these ocean current and wind patterns operate. Oftentimes, you have storms that build up off the coast of West Africa and then lead to what we know as hurricanes coming through the Caribbean and through the southern United States. And those are the same winds that brought the trade through.
Wow. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Justin Donovan, assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at UCLA. And coming up after a break, we will talk more about the environmental effects of the transatlantic slave trade. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are spending the hour with Dr. Justin Dunavant, assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at UCLA, co-founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists, and an instructor with Diving with a Purpose, an organization specializing in the protection and interpretation of African slave trade shipwrecks. Dr. Dunavant is a National Geographic explorer, and he's featured in this month's cover story, which I really hope you can take the time to read. And we linked to it at yourcallradio.org. It's called Into the Depths, Searching for Shipwrecks from Slavery's Hidden Past to Help Heal the Present. So in your talk, you say that when we hear about slavery, we are taught about the British, the French, and the Spanish, known as being the main colonial powers in the Caribbean. But the Danes owned three islands, the Danish West Indies, and operated those islands from the mid-18th century up until the early 20th century. So tell us first how you got involved in doing work in the U.S. Virgin Islands, specifically in St. Croix.
Yeah, the U.S. Virgin Islands was a sort of unique spot. I had never considered doing archaeology or doing research there until I was contacted by Diving with a Purpose, and they talked about this unique potential with the Slave Wrecks Project to develop a training program. From there, we took a visit to the Virgin Islands. I was then a graduate student, and we really sat down and outlined what it would look like for the first time to create an archaeology training program where we took local kids from the Boys and Girls Club and trained them in archaeological methods, just to expose them to what archaeology is, and then have colleagues with Junior Scientists in the Sea and Diving with a Purpose to train them in scuba diving. So now we would have middle school, early high school students that know how to scuba dive and have an interest in archaeology potentially. That's what brought us to the Virgin Islands originally. It was a sort of ubiquitous path. We had to sort of self-fund our way down there. So myself and Dr. Ayanna Fluellen used various means, including, you know, points from airlines, from other travels we had taken, and sleeping on people's couches while we visited archaeology sites. But thankfully, we were able to piece together this program, and now we conduct annually summer excavations in the Virgin Islands at a Danish plantation called the Estate Little Princess, which is now the headquarters for the Nature Conservancy. And there's a whole host of questions we ask, and I can expand on the project more if you're interested.
Yes, definitely. So you write, or you talk about the fact that when you read histories of St. Croix, they start in the Danish period around the 1730s, but there's a whole history before that that gets washed away for the most part.
Yeah, there's a whole history. And that's the other thing that we try to do is, you know, as archaeologists, we are taught to go beyond written records. So we have to fully explore what is the human interaction on this place from the very beginning, and what has it been even prior to European engagement in this area. And as a result of that, we go back to the archaeological work that's been done. So we see multiple indigenous groups throughout the Caribbean coming to St. Croix, the island then known as II, and using it as a site where people live, a site of ritual, a site of food procurement, and the different ways in which people in the Caribbean are so mobile and fluid. Then as archaeologists, we ask the question of, well, what has the archaeology that's been done here? And we realize that literally aspects of this history have been erased. There are indigenous belongings that are in museums in Denmark today, and people in the Virgin Islands will never get to see those or never get to understand what context they came out of. Mm. So it's also an element of us trying to piece together this story and this narrative that we've lost. And then what are the relationships between the two? What are the relationships between indigenous people in this place and the enslaved Black and the enslaving community?
You also point out, and this really, gosh, can apply to so many places around the globe, colonial powers did not know what they were doing, and so they had to rely on the knowledge of enslaved Africans on St. Croix to grow things like sugar, they grew cotton, they made rum. So can you talk more about that?
Yeah, you know, a lot of agricultural practices in the Americas are built off of indigenous and oftentimes African agricultural practices, in part because when they're, and many people have written about this, but when they're growing rice, for example, in the southern United States, they're using grains and strands of rice that are coming from West Africa that have been planted by West Africans, and they're actively trying to get West Africans who have experience with rice production so that they know how to actually get the biggest yield from these crops. The same goes with all of the commodities from sugar to tobacco to cotton. And so all of those elements sort of come together in the Caribbean, and we have to begin to more deeply explore what are those sort of knowledges, those intellectual sort of property rights around these things that individuals have developed over time, and understanding that there wasn't just a community of enslaved people that were just mindlessly working in these areas, but they were bringing skilled labor with them that was used to build these industries.
Right, exactly. And that's the other point you make that you say is St. Croix was carved up into plantations. Every square inch was divided into a plantation, and people from West Africa were constantly brought in to do the work. And then sometimes they would move on to the United States or South America, but millions were brought to the Caribbean, and then perhaps from there brought somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I tell people colonialism was and still is a giant experiment. Oftentimes these colonial powers have a goal or vision in mind, and there's little care or concern about the longevity or, of course, ethics or other elements of this process. So when you're talking about plantations in the Danish Caribbean, in the Virgin Islands, you're talking about a situation where they have an idea that they want to produce as much sugar and cotton as possible. They really don't care how it happens, and they really don't care what the environmental ramifications of it are. So you literally carve out the entire island into a series of plantations, and then you bring in as much sugar, as much individuals as possible to begin planting and growing as much as you can. So you can tax it and use that tax revenue back at home in Denmark. A lot of different colonial powers did this. It led to clear cutting of rainforests and a whole host of other issues as well.
Well, that was the other thing that was so interesting in your talk, and not surprising, but I just feel like we don't really focus on these issues, the environmental effects of the slave trade. We talk so much about where we are today, but as you point out, these plantations required land clearing. They had to spend 5 to 10 years doing nothing but clearing the land, which leads to deforestation, land erosion, and then, of course, soils become depleted, massive environmental destruction, and all of this is really still felt to this day.
Right. You know, Rose, the wild thing is that we don't even know what these places looked like before Europeans got here. Wow. There are stories of these, and, you know, we'll do some scientific work to uncover species of plants, but there were entire old growth forests that existed in Georgia and South Carolina that got clear cut to get the wood to be able to then use it as fuel in some of these steamships or to physically build the boats that were used during the slave trade. We'll never know actually what those old growth forests look like. Mm-hmm. The same can be said about underwater with some of these coral reefs and the coral mining that's occurred off the Virgin Islands and a whole host of other questions. So I think the powerful element of all this that I tell people is it's not only the fact that there's a whole environment that we don't know about, but the mentality that allowed that to happen still exists today. We still live in a world where we assume that all land deserves to be bought and owned by an individual or a collective, and that we can do whatever we want to do on this landscape without ramification. There are now talks about how we reframe our relationships to the land, but I think still, by and large, the legacy of colonialism is that mentality.
Right. Well, I was just thinking about the land back movement in this country. Since you brought up coral, if I remember correctly, you said that there was major environmental damage as a result of rum runners coming to the Caribbean, and that's why mm-hmm. the coral mining took place.
Yeah, there are multiple reasons for coral mining. One case was these rum runners. So there are rum runners were individuals who, it's not just the popular drink. I know many people may know the drink at the bar called the rum runner. But rum runners were individuals who were sneaking rum off of their plantations and off the island so they could avoid taxation. So many times they would come in through small bays or little coves. And in some cases that would involve actually clearing out and dredging the coral so that they could get some of these vessels close to shore so they could load them up and export their rum illegally. At the same time, a lot of coral mining actually occurred to build a lot of the buildings that exist in the Virgin Islands. The Virgin Islands doesn't really have good stone for building construction. So when you look at historic buildings in the Virgin Islands, they're often built out of brick that was coming straight out of Denmark or France, or they were built out of coral that was extracted from the ocean. And that was a whole process that's been documented in historical records, where oftentimes enslaved individuals were tasked with going out on canoes, using large wooden sticks to break up coral heads, and then free diving to actually pull those coral up onto the boat and then take that back to shore, where they would dry it, cut it out into blocks, and use it as building construction. So there's a whole host of collaboration and connection between ocean and land there. Hmm.
Today, we're speaking with Dr. Justin Donovan, assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at UCLA, and we're talking about the environmental effects of the transatlantic slave trade with a focus on the former Danish West Indies, which are now the U.S. Virgin Islands. Between 1500 and 1875, almost 5 million enslaved Africans were brought to the Caribbean, compared with 389,000 brought to the United States. About a million people died in transit. If you have any questions or comments for Dr. Donovan, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. We're just getting a lot of emails from people saying thank you so much for this great work. We do have a question from Carol, who says, I think the subject is astoundingly fascinating and phenomenal. Thank God for the insight and the willingness of individuals to do this work so that we people of African heritage have more of a connectivity to the continent. What ways can I contribute financially to support this ongoing project? Thanks again for telling the story. It makes it concrete that we have a greater story that is yet to be told and continually unfolding.
Thank you so much for those words. Yes, there are many ways to contribute. I say if you want to financially contribute, the Society of Black Archaeologists is a nonprofit organization that I currently operate in and co-founded. You can find that at societyofblackarchaeologists.org or .com. We also have Diving with a Purpose, which is another nonprofit organization. They have an adult program where they do training and education in underwater archaeology and coral restoration. And they have a youth program as well, where they take youth and do similar work. So I encourage you to check out that element as well. I'm also on the board for the National Marine Sanctuary Foundation, so I have to also disclose that our National Marine Sanctuaries are key sites of heritage. And we're actively working now to try to bolster that and get that to the national attention as well. So that's something else to explore. But outside of financial work, I mean, I think one of the biggest things you can do is continue to do research on this and to promote the stories that we're starting to push out. As I said, we're getting heavier and heavier into media and the ways in which we can get our research to larger audiences. So the more people share, the more people pass it on, I think all of that will contribute to our overall mission of getting worldwide attention around these questions and getting young people interested.
That is so important. And again, just thinking about, you know, Into the Depths being on the cover of National Geographic and, you know, at a time when we're learning so much and there's amazing people like you doing this great work above and under the water, which I love. I have to ask you, and I hate to ask, but I have to, because of all the book bans and, you know, slamming the 1619 project. I mean, just watching what happened at the Supreme Court hearings, I would rather not discuss this, but we can't ignore it. So I just wonder how you see all of this, where we take a step forward and then they try to pull us back with these, you know, horrific laws to not talk about certain issues, or you can't make people feel bad about history and on and on. What are your thoughts on all of that?
You know, Rose, I feel sorry for what they're doing to themselves in these instances, because at the end of the day, we are going to find ways to educate people on the things that they need to be educated on. That's part of the reason why we've pushed to media. They can ban critical race theory in a classroom, but we can find all kinds of other media outlets, from TikTok to YouTube to television to magazines, to explain the relationship between race, gender, and class, and the ways that it's structured oppression in this country. we can find ways to get young people interested in doing more archaeological work and historical work that doesn't necessarily involve them going to their K-12, but involves extracurricular activities, or it might involve diving, or it might involve other scientific research. And they can begin to see themselves and where they go in these places. The reason why I feel bad for what they're doing to themselves is because we can't do that work for everybody. We just don't have the capacity to do it. So then there's going to be a situation where some people are more in the know and have greater awareness than others. And at the end of the day, I think it's going to be those that have a more complete understanding of themselves, where they exist, and their relationship to this place that are going to be an advantage.
I love how you put that, and also just kind of seeing the anger that comes with all of it. You also have to feel bad about that because it comes from someplace, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think you just put it so beautifully. You know, I just wonder on a personal level, like at the end of the day, after you've gone on a dive and gosh, you're looking for a slave shipwreck, or you go to St. Croix and you talk with young people about all of these issues. I mean, in your talk, you talk about how if someone was trying to escape on St. Croix, an enslaved person, they would look at basically where the ocean current would take them. And I mean, this is heavy stuff. I mean, just again, on so many occasions I had to press pause listening to your talk because it's so intense. And I just wonder, you know, at the end of the day, when you go to bed, like, how do you process all of this personally?
Yeah, you know, it can be a lot and it can be heavy for certain individuals. For me, I see it as inspiring. All of it to me is inspiring. The fact that, you know, my ancestors had knowledges of the oceans in terms of how the ocean currents worked, how, you know, fish and marine populations existed and what we could tell about the water as a result of that. All of those things just make me more inspired and encouraged to begin to explore all the other things that I don't know or that I might have forgotten or that our community collectively might have forgotten. So every time I uncover a new piece, it gives me a new sense of hope. And then I try to find a student who's really interested in it so they can go ahead and explore that angle of it so I can keep going and doing this other work. But yeah, it's all inspiring for me. And that's the way I use it and turn that sort of sorrow, I guess, and pain that some people might feel into productive energy that we can use to continue to push forward with this.
Okay, I'm going to hold on to that because we talk about pretty intense issues on the show day after day, and we just have to always kind of hold on to the inspiration and keep going and the knowledge. And now that you have this amazing platform and doing all this great work, I mean, just to educate, I mean, I learned so much by listening to just one or two of your talks. Also learning, and I did not know this, that St. Croix actually had a slave revolt. It was the second major successful revolt after, of course, Haiti.
Yes. And I mean, and that's the wild part too. I didn't know that until I started working in the Virgin Islands. I also didn't know this continual legacy of colonialism as the U.S. Virgin Islands being a U.S. territory and all of the political implications in which that means. But this is what I'm saying when there's like so much history that we don't fully know. You know, St. Croix having that rebellion, they literally forced the Danes to outlaw slavery. They had a rebellion. They took over the fort. They demanded emancipation. And they received emancipation as a result of all of that. And I think that that's a critical moment that we need to understand that resistances were happening and continue to happen. People were involved in those, and their grandkids or their great-great-grandkids or their great-great-great-grandkids still continue to carry on those legacies and understandings of resistance. And then not just the slave revolt, but then also the labor revolt in St. Croix, which involved three, possibly four African women that were leading a revolt. People don't think of this idea of one, women leading a violent revolt, but then two, leading a violent labor revolt in the Virgin Islands and thinking critically about what the state of things had to be in this space to cause literally a burning of almost half of the island from plantation to plantation. So I think, yes, all of these bring up new stories then around what is it that we actually don't know about all of these complex histories.
Wow. Okay. So can you just give us a synopsis of that labor revolt?
Yes. I mean, it was the labor revolt. The full details have been disclosed. It's kind of interesting. I recommend people try to piece together this story because it's been pieced together from legal records from Denmark, from police records, and from other accounts. But essentially, a group of women organized and led this labor revolt. They went from plantation to plantation, burning plantations and also growing their numbers. until they were able to take most of the island. It was eventually suppressed and they were tried. A number of them went off in different directions. One of them was actually imprisoned in Denmark. And there's a statue that exists in Denmark to Queen Mary, who, as she's known, who was one of the labor revolt leaders. So there's an element too then of Black history that's in Europe that many people might not know if they walk by the statue. Like, oh, that's a woman who was in the Virgin Islands. And again, they came from all over the Caribbean, even though they existed in the Virgin Islands. So we're talking about a pan-Caribbean, pan-African revolt in St. Croix that transcends all of these borders. So it's amazing. And then we look at, you know, labor movements in the 1920s and realize this is a direct connection to that revolt and then to subsequent revolts.
And how do the children respond when you work with them and talk to them about this history in St. Croix?
You know, it's interesting. I think the kid, there's a number of kids that actually do have knowledge of these histories. I think it opens their eyes to the fact that they can actually touch it more deeply than they've actually been aware of it. So it almost provides you with a sort of new set of glasses that you begin to see the world around you. And I've found that it's been empowering for many individuals as well. They see the work that they're doing having a tangible effect. And it has an effect on their parents, too. They see their kids scuba diving, and they might not know how to swim. And now they say, I need to know how to swim so I can one day dive with my child. Or, you know, they came back home telling their parents what they are critical.
Mm-hmm. Oh, are you still with us, Justin?
Yes, I'm sorry. Can you still hear me?
Okay, yes, you're there.
Yeah.
We have a question from a listener who would like to know if all of this experience that you've had so far has affected your opinion on reparations and just how you think about reparations.
Yeah, great question. My idea of reparations, I'm still developing my ideas around reparations. I think it's definitely necessary. I think part of reparations is going to involve a huge component of research because we still don't fully know the impacts of what has been done historically during slavery and what has continued to happen through Jim Crow and into the present day era with redlining and other discrimination around housing. Particularly for me, the environmental angle is critical. And I'm starting to wonder and even assess the fact that we don't fully know the environmental impacts of slavery. So we can't say, you know, some of these Caribbean islands might need reparations around shoreline protection because plantation agriculture degraded shorelines, or they might need reparations around coral restoration programs because coral mining was such a significant factor. So I think as we begin to explore more of that, we'll understand to what degree we need to begin to have this reparations conversation. Mm.
Well, thank you for that question. We're actually going to do a show about this soon because just yesterday there was a task force on reparations for African Americans in California. And the task force voted to direct state compensation to the descendants of enslaved and free Black people who were in the U.S. in the 19th century. And the group said that a compensation and restitution plan will be based on lineage as opposed to one based on race. And I'm just reading from The Guardian here. So there's a lot to unpack there. So we'll definitely do a show about that in the near future. What is next for you, especially with the Society of Black Archaeologists?
Yeah, you know, the next step is we're continuing to grow the organization. So the Society of Black Archaeologists, we encourage you all to donate, or if you're interested in joining as well, you can go online and check out the organization there. I've actually used some of my funding from National Geographic to set up a scholarship program. So we fund research projects for individuals who do not exist in the United States, so non-US based archaeologists, so they can go ahead and do research in their communities. We also provide scholarship funding for archaeologists to travel and attend conferences to present their work as well. We're actively thinking through more programming. We now have colleagues in Francophone world and the Lusophone world. So we're often dealing with direct translation now as we're having these international conversations. And my own next project is going to be looking for Marcus Garvey's Black Star Line shipping company and those ships that were involved in that. And I think that's going to be a powerful movement as we begin to reinvigorate this notion of Marcus Garvey, what the Black Star Line was, and the impact of a Black-owned shipping company.
Wow. Can you give us just a quick preview? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, for sure. So Marcus Garvey founded the Black Star Line, which was a Black-owned shipping company. The intention was to provide shipping operations throughout the Americas and to ultimately take people back to Africa. And this was in the early 1900s. For a number of reasons, it eventually fell defunct. They said the FBI was involved in actually sabotaging the organization. Marcus Garvey was deported as a result of what was claimed to be mail fraud from the shipping company. And in conversations with Marcus Garvey's son, who is still living, there's active interest in moving forward to bring this story to light so that we can talk more about what Marcus Garvey's legacy was, what it is, and what it can potentially be in the future.
Wow. We'd love to have you back when you're involved in that project. We're also getting a few emails, more emails saying thank you for this great work. And can people get involved in this work?
Thank you. Yes, we're actively thinking through what involvement looks like. As you know, certain expertise are needed in certain areas, and there's a level of training that goes into this. But we encourage you to reach out to the Society of Black Archaeologists or to Diving with a Purpose. Diving with a Purpose runs an annual field school in underwater archaeology for people who are trained as scuba divers at the moment. And there's expansion as well in coral restoration, if you're interested in that, through there as well. Again, our colleagues at the National Marine Sanctuaries and the National Marine Sanctuary Foundation, there's a number of programs you can get involved in to get involved in your local oceans, bays, and rivers. There's also a number of programs that you can attend locally to get more interest in and understanding in archaeology. So we encourage you to explore that as well.
Well, Justin, it's been great to learn more about your incredible work. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Love to be back.
Thank you. Dr. Justin Donovan is assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at UCLA, co-founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists, and an instructor with Diving with a Purpose. That's an organization that specializes in the documentation, protection, and interpretation of African slave trade shipwrecks. Dr. Donovan is also a National Geographic explorer. He's featured in this month's cover story called Into the Depths, Searching for Shipwrecks from Slavery's Hidden Past to Help Heal the Present. And you can find more about his work with links to really interesting articles. I'll also put a fascinating video up where you can watch Divers with a Purpose in action at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for her help on today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show today. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.